Welcome to Ujiria, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Sandy Springs, Georgia. Ujiria is a Greek word meaning health of body and mind in aging individuals. Ujiria Radio is a weekly show celebrating Atlanta's heroes that contribute to the Ujiria of Atlanta's elderly and disabled population. Now joining us in the studio are your hosts, Sam Grass and Brad Culp.
Good morning. It's a chilly St. Patrick's Day morning. This is Brad Culp. I'm in the studio here with Sam Grass and Lee Cantor. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Brad. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I am doing okay. No green? You have green. Is that green, Brad?
This is green. Yeah. Sam's wearing green. Most of us are wearing green.
I'm not. I'm the one who's not. There you go. Hey, Lee, I knew one of us wasn't.
Hey, Lee, let's cut to the chase. Let's see if the trivia is related to St. Patrick's Day today.
You think it is?
We'll see.
Yeah, well, you know, St. Patrick's Day trivia, everybody does that, but we're actually going to talk about leprechauns instead of St. Patrick's Day.
Totally unrelated.
So here's the question. Do you know who or even what country brought leprechauns and St. Patrick's Day together?
So now you want us to say Ireland, but that's probably not the right answer. I would say Mars.
Russia.
Go.
Walt Disney, believe it or not.
Hey, it's America then.
Back in 1959, they had a movie out called Darby O'Gill and the Little People. And that really introduced us to leprechauns. But it introduced us to happy leprechauns. The traditional leprechaun in Irish folklore is a bad-tempered, nasty, treacherous little man. And so it never, in Ireland, was never associated with St. Patrick's Day.
Right.
Interesting. I think we have one of those short, bad-tempered little men in our studio.
And why are you looking at me?
I'm not going to touch that. You know, in other news, 1845, the rubber band was patented. And 2 years ago today, Governor Eliot Spitzer resigned. So how in the world I segue into our radio show from there, I don't have a clue. We do have a great show this morning, and we've got three guests in the studio with us. Up first, we have Janet Kemp up first from Southeastern Gynecologic Oncology. Following Janet, we have Debbie Church from St. Joe's Hospital, coordinator of the Cancer Survivors Network. And then finally, we have Anthony Johnson, who is a pharmacist and owner of Johnson's Hometown Pharmacy in Duluth. So we will start with Janet Kemp this morning. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your employer, it's a mouthful. It's difficult for me to say. I think you guys call it SIGO for
SIGO
short.
SIGO for short, yes.
And I suggest we continue with that. Okay.
But tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be with SIGO and how you got involved in the line of work that you're in.
Oh, certainly. I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer over 7 years ago, and my lovely employer at the time, while I was going through chemotherapy, decided that I no longer needed to be employed by them. So with all that extra time that I had on my hands, I returned to the chemo suite on all the days off that I now had, and sat next to my chemo buddies. And with that, SIGO offered me a position to start their SIGO Buddy program, which is a patient-to-patient support program that we have.
Tell us a little bit about the SIGO Buddy program. Describe that and give us the history. And I know you were, for lack of a better term, one of the founders, if not the founder of that program. So go ahead and talk to us about it.
I would say the SIGO Buddy program has been established to help support our gynecologic cancer patients. It's a volunteer program. Not everyone feels the need for support. But if they do, they let me know, and then I go about matching them patient to patient. What I try to do is match the newly diagnosed patient with another woman who's a few steps ahead of her so that she has someone that she can talk to and answer questions and feel the emotional support that truly no one else other than another cancer survivor can understand.
And why would a physician practice offer this type of service?
I think the question would be, why wouldn't they?
That probably is a better question.
That's a good question. I never have asked any of the doctors. My feeling is that they probably felt the need for it simply because when they're visiting with the patients, they are on a schedule, and when they have the confinement of a closed door in a closed room with a patient, the patient is more than likely to start to vent, and doctors don't respond to that very well.
there is logic to my madness here, and you and I had a conversation earlier before we came into the studio about a personal experience of mine.
Yes.
And having prostate cancer and going through the treatment there, about my experience of not being anxious or concerned because I had an older brother that was literally 9 months ahead of me in the process, and I just rode on his shirt tails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It really does.
What percentage of patients take advantage of this kind of buddy program?
I would estimate probably about 30-40%.
So that's a pretty shockingly low number, I would think.
It is. I think a lot of it has to do with proximity to, if a patient...
Where the events are, right.
If we have special events, a lot of it has to do with proximity and their ability to get transportation to the event and such.
So you must have been feeling a need when you were going through this in order to motivate you to come back and do this on your own without being paid.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think as many cancer survivors, when they first get the diagnosis, they go online and they read more than they probably should. And I, for one, did that because I had taken a short term of leave while I had my surgery and before I started chemotherapy. And I read online that patients who receive support, any kind of support, whether it's a one-on-one patient matching support or if it's a group support, they do better through treatment and they do better living beyond treatment. So I was ready to have that for myself. So I think that's part of one of the main reasons why we try and support this with our patients.
Can you, at a high level, Janet, paint us a picture of the type of information support that's offered to the patients? What type of information is available? How do they obtain that information? Is it one-on-one conversations? Is it through written material? Things of that nature.
If you're speaking in terms of receiving medical information or just support?
Support and information about the ovarian cancer or whatever they may be going through.
Most of it, truly, patients get most of that information up front. Mm-hmm. They get it on their own. We have, at our practice, we have a chemo class. Mm-hmm. It's not required, but we do encourage our patients to attend. And in the class, they receive all the information that they need to know about the journey through chemotherapy as far as blood lab work and different types of treatment, because every treatment has different timing and different lab work requirements and what have you. So the chemo class is very important. In our support program, we also provide our patients with just as a plethora of information about what's offered in the community. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got involved with Cancer Survivors Network, is that I really feel that this is my calling, changed my career completely. But anything I can do to give back to my community is why I'm still here.
Now that's a good segue into the Cancer Survivor Network. Give us a brief introduction to that and where it is located.
Well, the Cancer Survivor Network is part of St. Joseph's Hospital here in our community. And what we offer are just a number of more educational programs so that the patient can come and get group support. We have lunch and learns where we have guest speakers come and talk to the patients and their caregivers. We also have some cooking classes. That seems to be probably one of the number one points of interest for a cancer patient, is what can I be doing while the doctors are doing everything that they can do with the chemotherapy and the surgeries and such, what can I be doing? And nutrition is something that we all can embrace. So we have a lot of classes on that.
How are the physicians dealing with this when you have peers kind of sharing, oh, this works for me or this doesn't work for me? Are the doctors good with that, or do they get a little defensive? Because like you mentioned earlier, as soon as somebody gets a diagnosis, they're online and they got, now they're the expert because they watch House and they, and then they went to WebMD. So now they're just like a doctor now. And some doctors don't like that because they're like, look, I'm a doctor. I went to school. Just that's nice. You think you know something. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot, sometimes they're patronizing. So do they embrace what you're doing, and do they, you know, say thank you for doing, I'm appreciative that you're doing this because you're taking a lot of headaches away from me? Or are they like, oh, great, another source of somebody getting misinformation?
I think they do embrace it because we encourage our patients to tell us things that they might be doing, whether it is taking a nutritional supplement mm-hmm. or something. Mm-hmm. We need to know that, and we tell the patients from the get-go that we need to know those things because so many times supplements may interfere with mm-hmm. the chemotherapy. The supplement may not be enhancing what we're doing with the chemotherapy. It may be interfering, and so we need to know those things. A good example, we always tell our patients this one little story about how a patient was on a clinical trial that we offered, and one of the side effects of the clinical trial was that her platelet counts dropped. Mm-hmm. Well, when you don't have enough platelets in your bloodstream, you tend to bruise easily, and God forbid if you got a cut, it won't clot. So she was scheduled to go overseas to England on a trip, and we knew that her platelet count was down to something ridiculously low, like 5, and the normal count is supposed to be in several hundred thousand. So we were encouraging her not to go, but she already had this scheduled, and she was so excited, so she went. When she returned, she said, you know, when we were over in Scotland, we couldn't even find a baby aspirin. Well, we didn't know that she was taking the baby aspirin, and that 83 milligram of a baby aspirin was interfering with that particular drug on the clinical trial. That was causing the platelet count to drop, and once we removed it from her daily intake, her platelets rose on their own. So that's why it's so important to tell the doctors everything. Just tell them everything. If it's not important to them, they'll let you know, but we'd rather know than not.
That's a great piece of advice. Janet, the real reason that we have, we certainly appreciate this information, and it's very, very good for our listeners, but the real reason that we have you here has to do with a conference that's coming up that is sponsored by St. Joseph, of which you are the lead volunteer. So with that introduction, I'm going to turn it over to you and tell us about this conference and when it is and where people how people can attend.
Certainly. excuse me. The Cancer Survivors Conference is called Sharing the Journey, and it's an annual conference, and this year is our 10th annual. And it's hosted at St. Joseph's. They have a Carroll Educational Center that's within the hospital. It's a beautiful facility with classrooms and an auditorium. And the day on March 27th, it's a Saturday, registration starts at 8 o'clock in the morning. We have a day filled with guest speakers. They range anywhere from medical doctors to research doctors to social workers to integrative oncology practitioners, people that specialize in art therapy and things like that. The cost is $10. Parking is free. We provide breakfast and lunch and snacks. So it's really a great value for a day filled with a day of celebration for surviving cancer, and you get to meet other cancer survivors as well. And I'm proud that one of our opening ceremonies, we're going to have 28 cancer survivors with their cumulative years of 437 years surviving all different kinds of cancers. Wow. And I think that's going to be a great visual for people attending the conference to see all of us.
Now, the conference is not specific to ovarian cancer, but it's
all cancers.
All cancers, okay. Mm-hmm. All
right. And how many people do you expect to attend?
We're expecting about 200.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's great. Janet, for our listeners, tell us what piece of advice that you might be able to give that individual who is facing cancer treatment or a diagnosis of that?
My best advice for anyone, even before you may think you have a cancer diagnosis, is to pay attention to your instincts. I think when I talk to our patients, more times than not, we can all look back and say, you know, I felt something wasn't quite right, and I either got so busy with my schedule. Many of our patients are teachers, and they wait until the summer break to go see their doctors. So they wait. And the longer you wait, there's a less chance that you can catch this cancer early. And the key to survivorship is trying to catch the cancer early.
That's great. Once again, for our listeners, tell us the location, date, and time of the conference. And if you will, if we have listeners who might be interested in contacting CECO, give them that information, please.
Certainly. The Cancer Conference is on March 27th. It's a Saturday. Registration begins at 8 o'clock. It's located at the St. Joseph's Hospital in the Carroll Conference Educational Conference Center. And the cost is $10, and parking is free, and you're provided with lunch and breakfast, lunch, and snacks, so it's a great value for the day. To reach me at CGO, Southeastern Gynecologic Oncology Practice, you can either email me, and it's Janet, J-A-N-E-T, dot Kemp, K-E-M-P-E, at S-E-G-Y-N-O-N-C.com, or you can call my direct line, which is 678-420-4129.
We appreciate it, and for all of our listeners, please, if you have the time, I would encourage you to attend the conference. Thank you, Janet.
Thank you very much. Uh-huh. Thank you.
Our next guest is Debbie Church, and Debbie, much like Janet, is tied to the conference.
Right.
Debbie is the coordinator of the Cancer Survivors Network of St. Joseph Hospital. Good morning, Debbie.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Tell us, Debbie, first of all, a little of your history background. And I know you have I won't say it's a unique degree, but it's something that's a little bit different as it relates to what you're currently doing.
Well, I began my oncology experience about 18 years ago, and I am officially trained. I have a Master of Divinity from Southeastern Seminary at Wake Forest, and I went into medicine, this particular type, as a chaplain, and I guess I was a frustrated doctor because I always wanted to be a doctor. So as a chaplain, I was around the hospitals, and I enjoyed working with patients and their diagnoses. And when I was a chaplain intern up at North Carolina Baptist Hospital in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, I did a lot of oncology work there. And over the years, oncology has just changed dramatically. You used to be one chemotherapy, one radiation, whole body radiation, and truly it was a death sentence almost back then. If you could not catch it early, if you could not remove it surgically, it was a death sentence. But over the past 20, 25 years, I'm telling my age now, but over those years, it has just changed dramatically that we have targeted therapy, combinations of chemotherapy. The radiation is just targeted, and it's become a chronic disease rather than a death sentence. It's curable. It is curable, and that's why we strongly recommend for people to get checked early for different types of various problems, just as Jan talked about. Pay attention to your body. Pay attention to what it's saying to you, because normally it does tell you that something's wrong, something's not quite working right, and you want to go early. The diagnosis early is the greatest prevention and care for any type of cancer diagnosis.
If you can, I'm assuming you can, speak to the cancer practice and cancer treatment abilities of St. Joseph Hospital.
Well, St. Joseph's is unique in a lot of different ways. We have robotic surgery for prostate cancer, which is unique. We also have a gamma knife radiation center, which treats brain mets or brain tumors. We're the only ones in Georgia that have that capability. And we are able, with that particular program, we're able to treat, if you know anything about brain metastasis, a lot of times breast cancer goes to the brain, lung cancers, those types of cancers like to travel, quote unquote, to the brain. But a lot of people will have three or four or five metastases in the brain. And we're able, with the gamma knife, you're able to treat that, all five or six of them, and at the same day. And that's unique. Mm-hmm. And the radiation that you receive is much less than the whole brain radiation or something else. And so the Gamma Knife is really a great cutting-edge therapy, and St. Joseph's is the only one in the state that has that. So we're unique in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Cancer Survivors Network is unique in the sense that we have over 300 volunteers that have started this program several years ago, I think over a dozen years ago. They came together. They knew that the interaction that they needed and the support from other cancer survivors was essential in their journey. And so St. Joseph's picked up on that. And they're unique as a hospital system to be able to support that number of volunteers. And so through their vision, we've been able to increase that with programs, support groups, doctor sessions where we have second opinion type of sessions, and just a continuous thing for survivors and their caregivers, because both of them are so intertwined together.
So you had formerly worked with Northwest Georgia Oncology Centers. How did you end up at St. Joe's? How did you get hooked up with the Cancer Survivors Network?
Well, unfortunately, Northwest Georgia, because of Medicare cuts, they cut their support program, and I was director of support services there for over 7.5 years. Unfortunately, during that particular amount of time, I became a breast cancer patient myself. Mm. And so I think that was a God thing. God knew that I was going to need to have a year off. So in a way, it worked out okay. Mm. And I went through, I even went back to Northwest Georgia Oncology because they have such excellent doctors. And they treated me for breast cancer. And I went through chemotherapy, lumpectomy, finally a double mastectomy, and then radiation. So in 2008, I was diagnosed, and I see cancer through a different set of eyes, and I can truly say, I know how you feel. Mm-hmm. For 18 years, I've been an oncology counselor, and that's what I've done. I love working with cancer patients and their caregivers, but now I can truly say I understand their inner angst, their anxiety, what they're going through, because I've been through it. Yeah. Been there, and it's a different experience.
Can you talk a little bit about the chaplain program in hospitals? Like, how does that work, and what's the reason that a lot of hospitals have a chaplain?
St. Joseph's has a great chaplaincy program. They even have clinical pastoral education, which is a program that I went through at North Carolina Baptist Hospital. Right. And it's where Master Divinity students will go through and specialize in chaplaincy work within a hospital. And they train chaplains on how they should interact with patients and what they should do as far as different religions are concerned.
Right. It's non-denominational,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. And that's St. Joseph's goal, even though it is run and known as a Catholic church,
sure.
And it was started by the Sisters of Mercy, and that's really unique. But they're very aware about being interdenominational.
Now, is this something where a patient has to request it, or does the chaplain stop by every patient? How does that interaction kind of work?
I think that most of the time they'll go in and introduce themselves as the chaplain, and if they're interested in their services. And a lot of times also, if a patient requested, of course, that
sure.
would anybody would be able to see the chaplain. But most of the chaplains will go through and talk to them and just go in. And I, as a chaplain, when I went through, especially in the oncology floors, I was never refused. Most people would want to just talk to me.
And what would some of the conversations, what would they be? Is this a kind of that moment where you're reflecting about life? Major moments, kind of small talky?
Most of the time it's small talky, but then if you build a relationship with that patient, then and you open the doors for that,
right.
Then they will talk about it, because cancer still is thought of as life and death, life
right.
versus death, and am I going to die with a cancer diagnosis? It's unlike when you are diagnosed with diabetes, you don't think about it like
right.
that. And so those type of issues do open up, and that's why the support is so essential, either
right.
from a chaplain's perspective or like we have established in one of our programs is called the Living Room program, where we have volunteers that will go around and visit other cancer patients,
mm-hmm.
and they are cancer survivors themselves. And so we leave that open so that they can talk with other cancer survivors after they've just gotten a diagnosis of cancer, or maybe they're coming in for treatment or another surgery or something along those lines. So that type of support, emotional support, is very, very significant within a cancer population.
Right. So in the same vein, we were just talking about the chaplaincy program, but with respect to the Cancer Survivors Network, do you go out and kind of canvass the cancer patients at St. Joe, or do they have to come to you?
No, we'll go out and canvass them. We have the outpatient infusion area. That's where you actually get chemotherapy. That's right next door to me. And we go over there and we will talk to the families. And a lot of times, I can't say this enough, it's the caregivers that are going through a lot of trauma. Is the patient is kind of, okay, I'm going to do X, Y, Z, and that's what we're going to do. We're
right.
just going to go along the way. The caregiver feels helpless. What can I do to help my family member? Mm. How can I be supportive of them? And so giving them the opportunity or the ability to communicate and just share, and they don't want to feel a burden to the patient, and the patient doesn't want to feel a burden to the caregiver. Mm. So it's wonderful to have somebody that they could just talk to and ask questions.
Is there a system that helps the families kind of mobilize to kind of take on this kind of a project where you have someone ill, and now, you know, sometimes now the brothers and sisters have to get involved. It could be a parent, and now, you know, maybe the spouse of the parent has to get involved in a different way than they've typically been involved. Now brothers and sisters that don't live in town have to get involved.
Right.
Is that a big part about what you do?
Oh, absolutely. And just communication, and opening it up, and then the family dynamics are all different
right.
for everyone.
And the people that live in town may be feeling that they're
doing overwhelmed.
Too much.
Yes.
And then the person that lives away is not doing enough, and they feel guilty.
Right.
And, you know, it must
exactly.
be just...
Exactly. And for the elderly And we're called the sandwich generation for a reason, because we're taking care of our elderly parents as
right.
well as our kids in
right.
school.
Right.
And so we're the sandwich generation because people are living older and longer
right.
lives. And so it's a very difficult place to be.
Right.
So that kind of information is essential that we give to caregivers as well.
Right.
And that kind of support. So that's why we do both survivorship and caregivers, because they both need
right.
a lot of support.
A lot of support, absolutely.
Right, right.
Debbie, let's move over to the conference. And
great.
I know that you are intricately involved in that. Tell us about it. Tell us from the perspective of St. Joseph, why the conference and what value does it bring to the institution? And then I know there was one element that I want to speak of, and that is, and I'm going to say this incorrectly, so I will upfront put it out there, educational type credits for social workers.
Oh, okay. Well, it's St. Joseph's is truly the light on the hill, the Pill Hill, as it's known around Atlanta, but it truly is, and has offered this conference. And we're not making money by charging $10 a person, believe me.
Not with two meals provided.
No, we're not making money. So this is a gift to the community, really, and to cancer survivors and their caregivers, and to anyone who has been touched by cancer, because we will answer some questions for them about new technology. We have a professor coming from Emory, and he's going to be talking about integrated cancer research and how it affects nanotechnology, targeted, mm-hmm. real specific things, as well as lighthearted things. Our keynote speaker is from Minnesota, and he's a cancer survivor, and from what I've understood, he's the best, one of the best speakers that we've ever had. His name mm-hmm. is Nick Mezzacapa, and so from that to, like Jan was talking about, integrative therapies, art therapy, breathing and centering, that is what we're doing for our cancer survivors and caregivers. And like I said, anybody else who would like to come. As far as the CEUs go, we are offering social workers what they call related hours. Mm-hmm. They have to get 15 related hours every couple of years or something like that. So our related hours are going to be offered for our social workers. Unfortunately, not enough nurses have signed up. So we're not offering CEUs for nurses, but they will get some practical care by understanding what the cancer patients go through, and I think nurses would benefit from this as well.
Now, these related hours, that is in addition to continuing education credits, is that correct?
No. It's a different aspect of what social workers need. Okay. They need CEUs, and we're giving them related hours. So, so that's what social workers are getting.
Well, this looks like a terrific agenda. I'm kind of glancing down here, and you've got breakout sessions, you've got two general sessions, and it's really all day, isn't it?
It is, and it's a great day. We have prizes and weekends and door prizes that we're giving away for free meals, and it'll be a fun day as well as a day of learning and support, and where patients can interact with each other. That's a big part of the conference, and they'll be able to talk with each other. Hey, what'd you do about this situation, or what'd you do about that one? And that's a big part of support and communication with everybody. So that's a great aspect.
Well, I know my two co-hosts know that I'm not going to let you get it off the show without me plugging St. Joseph and St. Joseph's cancer treatment abilities, personally being there. And I've got a lot of clinical experience. It was superb, and I have no complaints at all, none whatsoever.
Well, thank you. St. Joseph's is out there to please, and I think it's a great place, and I would personally go there.
Debbie, for our listeners who, as we asked Janet the same question, for an individual who is facing this challenge, whether it be from the beginnings of diagnosis all the way through treatment and survivorship, what piece of advice might you give them?
As Janet said, be honest with yourself and also open yourself up to others and be able to ask questions, any questions that you have. Nothing is dumb. Nothing is something that you shouldn't cover and be comfortable with. That's probably the biggest piece of advice I would give to any cancer patient, is to be open and honest with your entire medical team, because we're there out to help you. And that's what I would say would be my biggest set of advice. And for the caregiver, I would say to take care of yourself too, because it's a very stressful job to be a caregiver, and to listen to your what you need, and you ask the questions too, but also take care of yourself and treat yourself to a day off. You don't have to be there 24/7, and that's a very important aspect of caregiving.
Great. That's great advice. And for our listeners, how can they reach you? Are there any web resources for the Cancer Survivors Network?
Yes, you can look on our St. Joseph's website, our main St. Joseph's Hospital of Atlanta.com. You can reach me at dchurch@sjha.org. And my personal phone number is where you register for the conference. So I'm pretty much staying there 9 hours a day. It is 678-843-5051. And anyone at St. Joseph's should know about the conference, and we're just really excited about it being not this Saturday, but next Saturday, March 27th.
March 27th. Well, again, thank you so much for being with us, Debbie,
morning.
And we're going to move to our final guest, Anthony Johnson, who is the owner of Johnson's Hometown Pharmacy in Duluth.
And that's in Buford.
Owen Buford.
My fault. I know we don't go do a show without me having one big boob, so that, there it is.
Anthony, you're actually a rarity here. You were born and reared in Duluth.
In Buford.
Buford. Okay. Thanks, Sam.
I told you.
That's good.
That's even rarer.
Did you do that on purpose?
Absolutely. I need to make the guest feel at ease.
Well, those of us from Buford are very particular.
I understand. Well, just give us a little bit of your background, growing up in Buford and settling in.
And your dream of being a pharmacist. Tell us how that started.
Yeah. All right. Mm-hmm. I was actually born and raised in Buford. I'm a local hometown boy. I attended the Buford City Schools, and while I was still in school, I actually started working at a local independent pharmacy. It was called Anglin's Drugstore at that time on Main Street in Buford. Very traditional, old-timey drugstore, soda fountain, the whole bit. Matter of fact, I started out as a soda jerk. That's what I did for a living. Became very interested in pharmacy at that time. Decided to go to the University of Georgia, where I got my pharmacy degree. Came out of pharmacy school, started working for one of the hospitals, worked a little while there, then a couple of the chain pharmacies. And Mr. Anglin called me about 14 years ago and asked me if I was interested in coming back, and I very much was. Independent pharmacy, once you've ever done independent pharmacy, you don't want to do any other type of pharmacy. And so I came back, and about 4 years ago, he decided to retire. So I purchased the pharmacy and renovated and did a lot of changes at that time.
Tell us why you like an independent pharmacy versus a chain.
There's no comparison. The independent pharmacy, if you come into my pharmacy, I'm pretty much going to know your name, mm-hmm. or I will know it before you leave, and you'll know me. You'll know my staff. We all call each other by first name, and we go the extra yard. So it's more like a friendship. It's not really our customers or our patients. It's really our friends and our neighbors, and that's a world of difference. People are looking for that. They're not looking for an impersonal chain type situation. And as such, over the last couple of years, our volume has doubled.
That's very interesting because, you know, clearly you've got the CVS's of the world and the Walgreens of the world that have the marketing power and the dollars and, you know, the draw. So it's really interesting to hear. Yeah, I mean, you kind of wonder, is the small town pharmacy going to go the way of the small town hardware store?
You know, when I was bought the store, there was a I don't mean to give CVS a hard time, mm-hmm. since you mentioned them. There's a CVS that moved down the street, probably not a mile and a half away, and my wholesaler at the time said, "Don't worry about it. Every time a CVS goes in near an independent, the independent will increase business," which is sort of a strange thing, but it did happen.
I have an inkling as to why, but I'm going to throw the question out to you. Right. What is the value of an independent pharmacy versus a chain pharmacy as it relates to pharmacology, polypharmacy, all that, those items?
Independent pharmacy is just so... And again, I'm not giving the chain pharmacies a hard time necessarily, but it's so much superior as far as, like I said, we're on a personal basis. You come in, I'm going to know you. I'm going to know what you're taking. There's so many people taking multiple medications, and interactions are taking place. I mean, I just have to give you a little bit of illustration. I had a fellow came in that actually a couple of weeks ago that has been on Abilify, which is a common drug for some depression, psychological type disorders, and they gave him a prescription for itraconazole, which is for a nail fungus, something very simple that you wouldn't think anything about. But yet, when you give that orally with the Abilify, it increases the blood level of Abilify almost twice, and with the potential of seizures and several possibilities. End up having to cut down the dosage of the Abilify in half. And that's just one illustration. If I can ramble,
let's stop.
If I were going to one of the big pharmacies, mm-hmm. and I only went to one, would they probably catch that?
probably, if you were going to one, and they've got to be watching.
But, of course, that's the issue, isn't it? Because right. sometimes that's you it. Go to CVS because it's close. Sometimes you go to Kroger because they're open 24 hours.
Or even more so, and excuse me, Anthony, but even more so, you go to Kroger's because the price at Kroger's for this particular script is cost-effective. You go to CVS for this particular script because it's cost-effective, and there's no one's coordinating that.
And that's a problem. If you start doing multiple pharmacies, multiple doctors, and most people do, you go to your general practitioner, you go to your cardiologist, you go to your dermatologist, what have you, and no one person is monitoring
right. and
your
then you,
medications.
And then throw in if this person's on some sort of supplementation, then you got, you know, now you're multiplying it again. But I have a question for you regarding what is the thought process of these big chains? They open up like every block, there's like another one. Like what... Is their business model different than other ones? Like, I understand yours. Yours is about relationships, personal service, high level of service. That's what you do. These guys, they just seem to be doing like a land grab. You know, they're just buying corners like gas stations used to.
Certainly, and strangely enough, several of these chains are not really doing really well.
Are they about the real estate more than the product?
Sometimes. I think that may be a factor. And even you have a misconception, too, as far as pricing with some of these stores. You automatically say because it's a Walmart or a CVS or a Rite Aid or something like that, that the price is going to be cheaper on something like that. And I'll almost guarantee you 9 times out of 10 I'll be cheaper than the CVS.
Right, so you're getting the better service and a better price.
But most people don't realize the price difference. You automatically assume because you can get a $4 prescription somewhere or a $10 three-month right. prescription somewhere that you're cheaper. And just about any product that those chains can offer for $4, I can do the same.
Right.
Anthony, let's go back, and I want to develop the theme. I got two things that we have to do. Obviously, I want to talk about the uniqueness of your pharmacy. But let's go back, and let's talk about pharmacology in the senior population. Right. Let's talk about the utilization and the potential interactions. And you and I have had this conversation earlier, so just begin there and start speaking to those issues.
That's definitely a very significant factor. It's statistically 12.7% of the population days over 65 years old. And of that 12.7%, they consume 34% of all prescription medications. And actually even almost a third of the OTC medications. Mm-hmm. And that's very, very significant. And there was a recent study at the University of New York that said that a patient who's on 6 medications has an 80% chance of having at least one drug interaction. So that's just a tremendous thing. And seniors in particular, just because of the kind of medications they take, they have a potential for drug interactions. A lot of things you wouldn't even think about.
Well, let's develop that statistic real quickly.
Okay.
You also told me that the average number of prescriptions per senior is what?
Actually, the average number statistically they're saying I believe is 14 now for a person
14.
Over 65.
Okay, so and then go back and say with 6 scripts there's an 80% likelihood of interaction. I mean, just do the numbers.
Start doing the math.
Yeah. Exactly. And we service assisted living homes. We have patients that have excess of 20 medications a month, every month.
So now, if that many people are having an interaction, then probably most of these interactions are kind of minor? And tell me about what kind of interactions or how they manifest themselves. And, right. you know, and then... You know, if they can get one person like you looking at all these and, you know, how might their life improve?
Certainly. Most of those interactions statistically would probably be minor. But there's also some that are very severe that actually can be fatal, particularly in the nursing home or assisted living home type situation with the elderly. Just an illustration, Coumadin, blood thinner.
Right.
Very common and very, very severe interaction, something very simple. One of your guests a while ago mentioned about over-the-counter medications. And with Coumadin, just simply taking an aspirin or taking ibuprofen or something like that can cause excessive bleeding and actually could cause death in that regard. Other things that you don't think about with Coumadin, things like antibiotics, like Cipro you may have heard of, and Floxacin, Avalots, there's several of them, or even erythromycin, BATs, and things like that can cause that Coumadin to increase the blood level and actually cause some bleeding and actually possibly a fatal bleeding with that kind of thing.
Now, do all these drugs, are the reason they're prescribed is because I'm seeing 5 specialists and then this one guy is saying, here, take this, and then He has no idea that I'm seeing two other doctors who are also doing this, and all of a sudden, you know, it's piling up, and now I'm spending my whole day, you know, taking medicine.
Certainly. I mean, it's very easy to start off with two or three drugs and then progress on to a dozen, 14 drugs very easily. And we do have multiple doctors that are not communicating with one another, and communication is really a key, I think. Communication with the patient, with their pharmacist, particularly if you got a single pharmacy, that's a big thing. Mm-hmm. Single independent, I'll plug an independent here, independent pharmacy, and communicate with your doctors. Although the doctors sometimes, and I'm not degrading them at all, but they're busy and they have a tendency to not ask those questions or not to look at those kind of things, and you need to communicate with them, particularly caregivers with elderly.
Do you ever communicate with them? Is it ever your
yes.
place to call doctors?
Yes, I do it every day, several times a day. Mm-hmm. If I encounter a drug interaction like the one I mentioned earlier, I had to call the physician, get the dosage changed. And that's something that would not have been caught until after the fact.
So I want to go back to the minor interactions because I think, you know, they're just probably by virtue of having 14 medications, just about anybody that's got that many prescriptions is having some kind of little interaction. And would those be things like maybe a headache or upset stomach or, you know, I mean, where to the point where if they had somebody like you evaluate their prescriptions mm-hmm. or even their doctor, they could improve their quality of life?
Certainly. And there are minor problems a lot of times, upset stomachs, think because of combining anti-inflammatories or something like that. It's a very simple thing. And that's something that we can do to interject there is that we can actually customize medications with us, an independent pharmacy. If I have somebody that's having some bleeding problems in their stomach or GI upset because of some of these anti-inflammatories, I can actually prepare a topical gel that they can apply topically, and it will absorb and will work for them and bypass their stomach problems.
Now, what's the industry term for that?
That's compounding, okay. Customized compounding.
All right. Now, do chains, and this is a general statement, but do chains compound? Will they do compounding or will
no? Yeah. No, it's a rule. It's not a profitable thing for the chains, and it's very time consuming, and it's just something that they don't do.
But how many times you're taking multiple drugs, you have an interaction, like you were saying, Brad, about now I have headaches, and then the doctor goes, here, take this for headaches, and all of a sudden now you're taking additional things to counter the interaction problems.
Sure, and that's how you end up with polypharmacy with a dozen drugs.
It's like they never say take less. Well, they're always adding.
Let's go back and look at the landscape of our medical industry. We have specialists, and they all are very good at what they do. But Dr. A doesn't know jack about what Dr. B does. And there's no central source to gather all the information and communicate, except for in the pharmacy. And the pharmacist can be that conduit and should be.
Yeah, that's a triad that's always there, the physician, patient, and pharmacist. Right. And the pharmacist is really this, I don't need to toot my own horn, but the pharmacist is the central gatherer of information there. It has to be. I mean, it's the only way they can work.
But that's the benefit of having that relationship with your pharmacist.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And you're missing quite a bit, and your health
suffers
a great deal.
Because what's happening, if you don't do it that way, then you're putting the onus on the patient.
That's
the patient becomes the key person, and the patient is the least educated out of anybody.
And we were overwhelmed with all kinds of other information, much less trying to be a pharmacist, doctor, specialist.
Right, exactly.
And the patients do not know. I mean, to be honest with you, I have patients that come in and taking medication. They have no idea what they're even taking it for.
Right.
Much less about it interacting with anything.
If there's 14, it'd be easy to forget.
Oh, sure.
And it's not because of a lack of education. I'm fairly schooled in this avenue, and yet I don't follow it because I don't have time and I don't want to do it. So, you know.
And you're going to stay up to date on all the medicines and all the latest.
But that's the point I'm making.
It's impossible.
That's exactly right.
Absolutely.
You've told us a little bit about your compounding at Johnson's hometown. Tell us some of the other unique services that you offer.
Other than compounding, we do assisted living homes. We do consultations with those and provide medications, the bubble packing for them, which is also a good thing, not just for the homes, but also for individuals that are having problems with compliance, that forget to take their medication, things of that sort.
And that's the beauty of the bubble pack.
Absolutely.
What is bubble pack?
Bubble pack is we take a single drug and we'll package it in cards, bubble blisters, punch-out cards. And they'll be from 1 to 30 or 31 on the cards. And if you punch out today's date, you just punch out the tablet on that date, that number, first, second, third, what have you. And that way you can go back and look, hey, I took this medication, or I didn't take it, and the caregiver will know. That's also an important thing with a senior citizen, is that the caregiver will know what's been taken and what's not. There's also another little device that we sell. It's called a Didit. I don't know if you've ever heard of a Didit, D-I-D-I-T, but it's a little device that attaches onto a prescription bottle. It just sticks on, and it's dated Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And as you take the medication, you flip the little tab over, and that way you can look at it and say, hey, I took Monday's dose. Mm-hmm. And so that's a nice little memory device to help you. Because even me, if I only take two or three medicines, I don't remember if I took it in the morning or not, you know. So that's very
common. So do you deliver the meds to then, or?
We do some limited.
Some like limited for the delivery. Assisted living?
The assisted livings we do, yes, almost a daily basis. Other than that, we also cater to diabetic clientele. We do diabetic shoes and, of course, the strips and all that. We bill Medicare. We're Medicare accredited for all that type of thing. Okay. We do home health care, durable medical equipment, wheelchairs, walkers. So anything like that pretty much that particularly a senior citizen would be able to use. But probably right now the biggest thing, I think the biggest personal thing is the compounding, is with the particularly with the seniors and with kids.
Yeah. So if you were going to give our listeners a piece of advice, what might that be?
Particularly in regard to the multiple medications, something very simple which can really have a profound effect on your health care, throw all those bottles in a paper bag, including your over-the-counter medications. Bring them to your pharmacy. Let the pharmacist look at them, see if there's any interactions, see if the dosage is correct. And that's the biggest thing. That and communicate. Please communicate, particularly over-the-counter things. There's so many times over-the-counter things are a problem. It's even herbal things, something simple. The ginkgo, the ginseng, feverfew, things like that. I'd mentioned the Coumadin while going. That will mess up the Coumadin. And so you've got to really consider things like that. That's normally you don't even think about, but that's a big thing. But communicate with your pharmacist. Keep a list of what you're taking. If not, ask your pharmacist to print you off a list of what you're taking. And again, the importance there of staying with one single, independent pharmacy. And that's a big thing. And talk to us. I mean, that's what we're there for, and we want to talk. So,
very good. And remind our listeners where your pharmacy is located and how to reach you.
It's in Buford.
We know it's in Buford. We've established that.
We're in historic Buford, 85 East Main Street in Buford, old part of town, right in the center of town. Been there for many years. This is a pharmacy that goes back to post-World War II. So it's
and a phone number?
770-945-9501. Or you can actually reach me on my cell phone if you prefer. That's 770-315-4103.
Wow. A pharmacist that gives out his cell phone.
Uh-oh. Did I say that on?
You wanted to be on this show.
Well, thank you again for being here, Anthony. And thank you to Debbie and Janet as well. Terrific show for our listeners. Thanks for tuning in. And if you want to listen to the show after the fact, www.ujiriaradio.com. And remember, if children are our nation's greatest asset, seniors are our nation's greatest treasure. Tune in at the same time next week for another great edition of Ujiria Radio.
Ujiria Radio is sponsored by Griswold Special Care and is recorded in the Business Radio X Studios.